This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On April 15th, 1861, the New York Times told its readers, "The darkest period in our nation's history has arrived." With the start of the Civil War, newspapers became more important than ever. A new book called The Most Fearful Ordeal collects the New York Times newspaper coverage of that war. It not only gives us an idea of how the battles were described in their own time, it shows the state of journalism in that era. My guest is historian James McPherson, who wrote the book's introduction and historical commentary. He's a professor of history at Princeton University and the author of several books about the Civil War, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning Battle Cry of Freedom. Here's a short reading from the beginning of George Smalley's report on the Battle of Antietam, which was written for the New York Tribune and was also published in the Times. Smalley was actually a volunteer aide for one of the generals at the battle.
"Fierce and desperate battle between 200,000 men has raged since daylight, yet night closes on an uncertain field. It is the greatest fight since Waterloo, all over the field contested with an obstinacy equal even to Waterloo. If not wholly a victory tonight, I believe it is the prelude to a victory tomorrow. But what can be foretold of the future of a fight in which from 5 in the morning till 7 at night the best troops of the continent have fought without decisive result?"
It wasn't easy for George Smalley to get his copy from the battlefield to the newspaper. James McPherson told me how Smalley did it.
"When it was over, he went to Frederick, Maryland, hoping that he could telegraph his report on what he saw to the Tribune. But the lines were tied up, and he couldn't get through. And so he hired a locomotive to take him to Baltimore. He tried to get through from Baltimore and couldn't get through. So he took a train from Baltimore all the way to New York, stayed up all night long and all the next day writing his article while he was riding on the train, and got into New York on the morning of the 19th and exhausted, hadn't slept for probably more than 48 hours, turned in his article, and the Tribune published it on the 20th, and it is generally regarded as, and it's several thousand words, it's 5 or 6 thousand words, it's generally regarded as the best example of Civil War reporting, and maybe one of the best from the 19th century.
What was the importance of newspapers for Americans during the Civil War?
Newspapers were really the only medium of communication for civilians in the Civil War. It's the only way they could find out immediately what was happening in the war. The telegraph had been invented about 15 years before the war, and during the 1850s, just about every part of the country was wired so that reporters could send in information from considerable distances to newspapers. And the War Department in Washington could get reports from far-flung army commanders and then give that information to the newspapers, so that unlike any previous war where there had not been telegraphic dispatches, people in Boston or New York or Chicago could read about military operations, great battles that had taken place just a day or two before.
News reports are often called the first draft of history. You point out in your notes in this book that the news reports were sometimes wrong. What's an example of that?
There was a tendency, and this was true of all newspapers on both sides in the war, especially in their first reports of a particular battle, to exaggerate the success of their own side, to minimize the casualties of their own side and to maximize the casualties of the other side, a little bit like the body count statistics that many of us can remember from the Vietnam War and that we're actually seeing again sometimes in Iraq. A good example of that is the Second Battle of Bull Run, which was one of the most humiliating Union defeats at the end of August of 1862. And the initial reports sent in by the special correspondent of the New York Times, talking about the Confederates in this battle, writes, "They are in a country utterly barren of supplies and have been too busy to forage for them if the country did afford them. The rations they carried with them must be exhausted, and the opinion therefore begins to be suggested as probable in well-informed circles that today's battle," the battle was even then going on, "or at least tomorrow's, must exhaust their resources and compel either a surrender or a hasty retreat. Well, a Northern reader reading that story would assume that the Confederates were on their last legs, that this was going to be a great Union victory, but then 2 or 3 days later, the news comes that, in fact, it was a great Confederate victory, and it's the Northerners who are beating a hasty retreat. So here is a story that raises hopes high only when the truth finally comes in to dash them all the more severely.
Since the treatment of prisoners has been such a big news story in the news from Iraq, I thought I'd ask you to read a paragraph that was from a news item in July of 1861, and this is about the treatment of the wounded Union soldiers by rebels who captured them. And would you read this paragraph for us on page 84?
I surely will. "The treatment of our wounded by the rebels is reported as having been brutal to the last degree. Several soldiers assert that they saw them repeatedly draw their knives and cut the throats of our men as they lay upon the ground. Others stabbed them with their bayonets and inflicted every conceivable indignity upon them. In charging up the hill on the Warrenton Road, they set fire to the house used as a hospital for our men, some of whom escaped the flames by getting through the windows. A Massachusetts man passing a wounded rebel stopped and gave him water, but had not gone 5 rods when he saw him trying to stab another wounded man lying by his side. Such brutality would disgrace savages." Let me say about that, atrocity stories like this were fairly common on both sides in the early months of the war, when the war was a novelty, when the level of demonization of the enemy was at its highest. As the war went on, I think, and as it became clear that these early stories were quite exaggerated, there were far fewer atrocity stories. People were more realistic about that. And while the treatment of POWs on both sides in the war certainly left a lot to be desired, and there was a high mortality rate among prisoners, that was more often a consequence of disease and neglect rather than deliberate atrocities. And this reporter in this story is reporting what he's been told. For example, several soldiers assert that they saw them repeatedly draw their knives and cut the throats of our men. He's not necessarily reporting what he saw himself. What's important about it, though, I think, is that when people in the North read this, they believed it. At least at first they believed it. I think they became more skeptical and even cynical about reports as the war went on, but it did a lot to mold Northern opinion, and for that matter, similar stories in the Southern press to mold Southern opinion in the early months of the war, and probably, I think, had something to do with making this war more and more bitter, violent, more and more thorough as it went on. The Civil War started out as a war merely to suppress an insurrection, a kind of police action. And as time went on, and as casualties on both sides mounted, and as the stakes for both sides grew larger and larger, the war became far more bitter, far more violent, far higher number of casualties. And I think these early atrocity stories probably had something to do with that.
Do you think the Civil War changed journalism?
It did change journalism. It gave a much higher profile to reporters and to reportorial journalism than had existed before that time. If you take a look at newspapers, even as late as the 1850s, they consist of shipping news, some financial news, short stories that are continued from one issue to another, unimaginative advertisements, a lot of editorials and editorial correspondence, but relatively few news stories of the kind that we're familiar today. The war really brought journalistic reporting into, or at least toward, the modern age. It came of age as a consequence of the war. I think there's no question about that.
My guest is historian James McPherson. He wrote the introduction and commentary for the new book, The Most Fearful Ordeal, a collection of the New York Times coverage of the Civil War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning historian James McPherson. He wrote the introduction and commentary to a new book collecting the New York Times reports on the Civil War. It's called The Most Fearful Ordeal. You know, one of the things that interested me in these reports
reports from the New York Times is that included in the reports from reporters, there's also reports from generals. You know, verbatim, it's their report. It's not folded into an article. It's just a dispatch from a military leader. In fact, I thought I'd ask you to read one because we don't read anything quite like this in newspapers anymore. I'm going to ask you to read a dispatch from General Hooker on page 184.
Let me preface that by saying that, in fact, much of what was reported as the initial information from the battlefield were telegrams sent from the front to the War Department and then passed along by the Secretary of War to the Associated Press, which was then, as now, a consortium of newspapers to pool information. And so you're quite right that much of the initial reports of fighting came from the front itself. And here is a report from General Hooker from Maryland on September 17th, 1862, which, of course, was the day of the Battle of Antietam. "A great battle has been fought, and we are victorious. I had the honor to open it yesterday afternoon, and it continued until 10 o'clock this morning when I was wounded and compelled to quit the field. The battle was fought with great violence on both sides. The carnage has been awful. I only regret that I was not permitted to take part in the operations until they were concluded, for I had counted on either capturing their army or driving them into the Potomac. My wound has been painful, but it is not one that will be likely to hold me up. I was shot through the foot." That's entirely accurate. Even an historian who knows about the battle can say that Hooker was telling the whole truth in that very short dispatch.
And it's a really interesting dispatch, and something different than what we see in newspapers now, since, you know, military dispatches aren't printed verbatim like that. It's a very different description of the battle than a reporter filed. And I thought I'd ask you to read a description of Antietam, which was one of the worst battles of the war. Before you read this description, why don't you just describe why Antietam was so important?
The Antietam was fought in September 1862 when the Confederates were on a roll, and it was an invasion of Maryland by Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia that was happening at the same time that another Confederate army was invading Kentucky. And these dual invasions were hoped in the South that it would knock the North out of the war, that it would achieve British and French recognition of the Confederacy, that it would undermine the Lincoln administration in the fall congressional elections of that year. And so the Northern victory in that battle was really reversed the momentum toward Confederate victory in the fall of 1862. And it was one of the first major turning points in the war that led ultimately to Union victory. It was also the single bloodiest day in all of American history. It was a one-day battle with about 23,000 casualties, 6,000 of them killed. And no other day in American history has so many Americans been killed. Here's the description by the reporter, and it's really quite eloquent. "Late last night and early this morning, I visited the scene of the most deadly conflicts during the battle yesterday and examined particularly the plowed field where Hooker's, Sedgwick's, and Banks's troops in turn contended against the rebel hosts, and the side hill, the cornfield, and the road where French's left was repulsed, and where Richardson's division gained so signal a triumph, and Mahar's, Caldwell's, and Brooks' brigades made such terrific slaughter in the enemy's ranks and gained imperishable renown. The dead and wounded were strewn upon the places indicated in hideous confusion. Here was a perfect winnow of butternuts and graybacks," these were Confederate soldiers, "interlanded with Uncle Sam's bluecoats. At another point, the dead and wounded rebel and Union troops were in heaps, as if designedly placed so for a funeral pyre or an auto da fe, without the combustible material. And everywhere could be seen stern, unmistakable evidence of the desperate struggle which always characterizes civil war among the whole human family, be it between a savaged or civilized people. Here was the pile made by Kirby's battery. There was a heap by Thompson's and Hazard's grape and canister, when the real leader, maddened to desperation by the exigencies of the hour, hurled his massed columns upon certain destruction. Scattered here and there were groups of blackened corpses, indicating but too plainly the deadly certainty with which the German New York battery hurled its thunderbolts from the hill east of the Antietam. Mangled humanity in all its ghastly forms could be seen upon this field. To the left, to the right, behind and before, on every hand the eye beheld the horrors of the field. Mingled with the dead came up to the ear the groans of those in whose breasts there yet remained a spark of vitality, but whose lamp had nearly expired. The hopeful cases, so far as possible, were removed for medical assistance before midnight of Wednesday. The hopeless cases were allowed to remain upon the field. Some in a perfectly conscious, others in a half-conscious state, while more were insensible to all worldly affairs. One of the latter class, a rebel soldier, while we were walking over the field at night, vainly attempted to rise. He had received a wound upon the temple from which the brain protracted. He clutched at the air, and a helping hand was extended to him, and words of sympathy were spoken, but no sign of recognition followed. And in a moment more, the helpless victim fell over upon his face and was numbered with the dead. God grant that we may never witness another such scene.
This collection of the New York Times coverage of the Civil War also includes coverage of the assassination of President Lincoln, and it includes coverage of the execution of John Wilkes Booth's co-conspirators who were hanged. And those co-conspirators included a woman. Was it very unusual to have a woman hanged?
It was extremely unusual, and therefore it was highly controversial at the time and has remained so ever since in historical literature. There were debates at the time and have been debates since then about the degree of Mary Surratt's guilt as part of the conspiracy. She certainly knew what was going on in the plot to kidnap President Lincoln, which preceded the plot to assassinate him. Her son, John Surratt, who escaped, was very close to Booth, and she was also close to Booth, so she probably knew more than her defenders have conceded. But whether she should have been hung, she was mostly an accessory before the fact, I guess you might call her, and the punishment may have been too severe, but the fact that she was a woman made it even more controversial, because as far as I know, no woman had been hung before this time in American history.
There's an actual description of the execution that was printed in the Times. I'd like you to read that, because I think it's just very interesting to hear this document.
All right, here is the description from the Times. General Hartranft read the order of the War Department embracing the President's executive order for the execution. The limbs of each of the prisoners were now pinioned. The caps were drawn over their heads, Mrs. Surratt exclaiming in a faint voice, "Don't let me fall. Hold on." Adzerott exclaimed in a loud tone, "Gentlemen, take warning." Then, after an interval of about 2 minutes, he said, "Goodbye, gentlemen who are before me. May we all meet in the other world." It was now 25 minutes past 1 o'clock. The officer in charge of the scaffold here made some preconcerted motions to the attendant soldiers to step back from the drop. And then, with a motion of his hand, the drop fell, and the bodies of the criminals were suspended in the air. The bodies fell simultaneously and swayed backward and forward for a few minutes. Mrs. Surratt appeared to suffer very little. Payne and Harold, on the contrary, writhed in apparent agony, the first for about 2 minutes, and the later for about 5 minutes. The muscles of their feet and hands were visibly contracted. Payne's hands, which were more exposed than the others, became purpled, as did his neck near where the rope was fastened. Adzerott's agony seemed, like Mrs. Surratt's, to be of but very short duration.
In the war in Iraq, the military encouraged anyone who was reporting on the war to apply to be an embedded reporter, as opposed to just going off on their own. What was the military's reaction during the Civil War to the reporters covering the battles?
That varied enormously from one commander to another. There was no centralized policy on this in the case of the Civil War, as there has been in more recent wars. And some military commanders welcomed reporters, especially if the reporters would write flattering things about them. Others hated reporters. Most notably in that area, in that respect, was General William Tecumseh Sherman, who barred reporters from his units, drove them out if they tried to sneak in. When he heard once that a reporter had drowned on the Mississippi River, it turned out not to be true. But when he first heard that, he said, "Well, now we'll have news from hell before breakfast tomorrow morning." That represented his opinion of reporters. General Meade, after reporters in 1864 had written something unflattering about him in the Wilderness Overland Campaign, banned reporters. From then on, the reporters all agreed that they would never mention his name favorably in any of their newspaper articles. So this varied from general to general.
Well, James McPherson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
James McPherson is a professor of history at Princeton University. He wrote the introduction and commentary for the new book, The Most Fearful Ordeal, a collection of the New York Times coverage of the Civil War. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.